Welcome to the Theology Upstream podcast, a podcast sponsored by Myers Park Baptist Church, a church that is bold in spirit and open to all. We are two young clergy people tackling theological concepts by engaging relevant books with a theological imagination, working to make theology accessible for a broader audience and connecting it with daily spiritual practices. We also need to confess that we are hopelessly optimistic that the church still has something relevant to say to people who live their lives in today's world. Welcome back, folks. It's Chrissy and Ben. We're here beginning a new book called Everything Happens for a Reason and Other Lies I've Loved.
What an amazing title.
Right? Doesn't it make you want to read the book?
The hard thing about this book is that the big part of the title, Everything Happens for a Reason, is in bold, and then the Other Lies I've Loved is small.
I know, and that's the best part.
I know. It's like subtle. It's a subtle critique of her own title, which is amazing.
Do you think that's intentional?
Probably.
And you know what? If you look at the title, it's And Other Lies I've Loved, and it's like, it's lined across the whole title.
Right.
So while it's kind of hidden in the background, it's the most prominent thing on the page.
Yeah, the lies I've loved are the prominent part.
Right.
That's amazing.
So interesting.
And people say everything happens for a reason a lot, don't they?
Oh, they so do.
It's a theological concept.
You know, this reminds me of a conversation we were having yesterday, and because I'm thinking, like, what are the lies that I've loved? And remember that piece about perception and reality?
Yes. That was awesome.
Anyway, so we were asking ourselves yesterday, does perception make reality or does reality make perception?
Yeah. It's like people say perception is reality. But Chrissy said yesterday, reality is perception.
And then Ben tried to tell me I was wrong, but I'd already said it. So I had to dig my heels in and I was like, why don't you think about that, Ben?
Yeah, actually. And she's from a philosophical perspective, you're right. Reality
Ooh,
is perception.
That.
Yeah.
Chrissy's right.
So this book is by Kate Bowler, who is an amazing person who wrote this incredible memoir dealing with her struggle with a cancer diagnosis. And it's one in a long series of right now, which I consider to be a renaissance in Christian life in America, of spiritual memoirs, particularly those written by women. And it's changed the game for many women in theological circles of gaining a much more prominent voice by telling their story through theology in a memoir fashion. I mean, you've got Rachel Held Evans, you've got Glennon Doyle Melton, you've got Heidi Newmark. I mean, the list could go on and on and on and on and on. And Kate, as I think this offering in the midst of all those other memoirs rises up as a really powerful example of that genre and is just a really well-written memoir as well. Kate is a professor of history, Christian history at Duke, and her specialty is the prosperity gospel. And she was raised in a Mennonite family. And just the juxtaposition of being raised Mennonite and then being a scholar of the prosperity gospel.
Yeah, I love that. And, you know, I want to touch on that, but I also want to touch on the list of the women who are writing spiritual memoirs that you named. One of the things that's most fascinating about this for me is that they're not religious scholars.
Right.
For the most part. And they're not ordained clergy people. I guess Kate is a religious scholar, but just –
Yeah, but that's rare. But that's actually the rare version.
It is. What I'm seeing is, like, whereas in the 90s, you know, there was a lot of religious scholarship that was coming out of the academy with, like, Bible scholars or Jesus scholars who were writing the books everybody wanted to read. You know, those were kind of – their words were speaking to the questions of the culture. But what's happening now is that people are writing really powerful books that are academically credible, but they're not coming from within the academy.
That's right.
And they're deeply spiritual because I think they have a – at least the women that you name, they have a unique ability to name a reality and an experience and to hold it up with the big question.
Right.
And to deal with it in a messy way.
Yeah.
So I just really love that.
Well, Anne Lamott was like in some ways is a pioneer of this this genre. Sort of the way that she tackles things, sometimes abrasively, and
she gave women the permission to cuss, right?
Yeah, even being sacrilegious and in a funny way, and owning her, but also vulnerably and honestly owning her story, really changed the game for the way women have engaged in this. I mean, there have been some men who wrote spiritual memoirs, but they're not nearly as popular or as well-read or in some ways as strong as the memoirs that we have from women. And you're right. Kate is rare in the fact that she's actually a scholar who's written in the genre of memoir. So in some ways, this is kind of more like Augustine's Confessions than the other memoirs That's that we cool. have.
Yeah. I wonder how she would feel about us making that bridge. No, but to touch it back on the religious component, you know, being raised Mennonite and then studying prosperity gospel, you couldn't have two more conflicting theologies of money.
Exactly. Yeah, because, I mean, Mennonites are very frugal, very simple, and some of the most simple Christians, and I'm not talking about that in terms of intellect. They're very smart, but they live simply. They still live on farms. They've resisted lots of forms of westernization and capitalism and the Industrial Revolution. And, you know, they don't – they have all kinds of practices about that – about renunciation of possessions and that living in community together has developed over the years. So like one of the jokes that I used to be told about Mennonites, because there are a lot of Mennonites that go to Duke, including Kate's not the first one. There were many that were there when I was there. And I think it's because Stanley Hauerwas deals with John Howard Yoder's theology, and he was a Mennonite and kind of brought a Mennonite theologian into the public sphere as a conversation partner with Reinhold Niebuhr. And by doing that, a lot of Mennonites saw themselves and were like, oh my God, we can like actually be, do theology and be taken seriously. So let's do it. And it was a renaissance for the Mennonites, and she's a part of that process. And they like growing a mustache one of the reasons that Amish and Mennonites don't have mustaches and have that beard without the mustache is because mustaches are seen as a source of pride.
Huh.
So even something as simple as a mustache.
That's so funny that that would be seen as a source of pride.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not judging. I'm just saying that never would have occurred
to
me.
Most folks would not see a mustache as a source of pride.
No, a full beard maybe. But
yeah,
like,
maybe like an epic Moses beard like most of the hipsters are trying to grow now.
So my favorite line from the preface, I think, is at the bottom of page, 11? So it's Roman numerals. Mm. So we might be stumbling through some numbers. But she says, everyone had a grandpa who once ruined a gleaming new car by painting the bumpers black to hide the chrome and knew that the most holy words found outside of the scripture were, I got it on sale. I love that. And I like every time, you know, we're kind of anticipating where she's going with this with prosperity gospel, but holding that, like hiding the shininess of the new car.
Oh, yeah.
With like, God bought me this airplane.
Right.
You know, you couldn't be more different.
Right. And it really starts to play out for me, just to be vulnerable personally, about thinking through, like, what does it mean when members look at the car that I'm driving as pastor? And what does it speak? And what does it say? And some places it's like, oh, yeah, of course our pastor drives a BMW. They should. You know, that's what we want them to be driving. And at other places, it's like our pastor should not be driving BMW because suddenly we think they're being overpaid and we need to reduce their salary.
That's right.
So it's like a very
– and every 50-something-year-old pastor that I know gets like the most fully loaded Avalon.
For sure.
You know, because it like still looks modest.
Right. And
you
it's like basically a Lexus, but it's got
it
the
Toyota on
label on it, so they think that it's not. Right. Yes. Yeah. And it's like this game that you're playing about like what kind of car should I drive? What do my members think about my money as their clergy person? What kind of example am I setting for my members in as far as what they're doing with their money and their stewardship? I mean, it's an amazing thought process, but it also shows the dichotomy between Mennonite conversation and the prosperity gospel churches, which is the other direction. Like,
that's right.
Why isn't my pastor driving a jet?
Yeah. You know? Well, because the financial – like the financial gain and kind of ability to accrue is seen as a blessing, right? It's an indicator of faith.
Yeah.
Right.
I think we should back up and just kind of talk a little bit about prosperity gospel. Some of our folks, this may be their first introduction if you're listening to this podcast.
In Charlotte, North Carolina, I find that hard to believe.
Yeah, if you don't know what prosperity gospel is in Charlotte, then
you've
maybe been under a rock for a while. But maybe just kind of talking through the relationship. The way she defines prosperity gospel is a little different than other ways to do it. Mm-hmm. On page 13 here in my version of it, she says, the prosperity gospel is a theodicy, an explanation of the problem of evil. It is an answer to the questions that take our lives apart. Why do some people get healed and some people don't? Why do some people leap and land on their feet while others tumble all the way down? Why do some babies die in their cribs and some bitter souls live to see their great-grandchildren? The prosperity gospel looks at the world as it is and promises a solution. It guarantees that faith will always make a way. The reason I love that definition is because – and this is one of the reasons I love her book. She makes prosperity gospel relevant to the lives of even those who think they've rejected it. including herself.
Yeah.
And so even if you think you don't agree with prosperity gospel at all, she's going to point out ways where you have subtle hints of this in your theology, whether you know it or not. And all of us have this prosperity attitude built within our theology that either we're still trying to work to get rid of, or we're wrestling with, or we're uncognizant of. And that was what was startling to me as I went through, is how much of her story I resonated with.
Yeah. Well, even that line, faith will always make a way. I want to say yes.
Like, yeah.
I mean, we might disagree as to the way faith makes.
What does it mean?
You know, yeah. But, you know, I too am always looking for faith to make a way.
Right.
And I'm also very resistant to the fact that, especially when you're talking about illness, that the way might be death.
Right. The way might be death.
You know, and really just owning that and leaning into that dark, kind of murky, because to me that feels unresolved, but that is in itself a resolution.
Right. And it is a way. It's just not the way most people think. Faith makes a victory.
Right.
Not faith makes a way, right?
Exactly. And, you know, but I appreciate the distinction that you're making here with her definition of prosperity gospel versus what some of us think when we hear prosperity gospel.
Right.
Because for us, prosperity is such an economic word that we think prosperity gospel is a faith-based economic practice.
Right.
Right? That is inherently tied with a capitalist kind of philosophy. But what she's saying by reframing it as a theodicy, which – correct me if I'm wrong, but when I hear theodicy, I always think, why do bad things happen to good people?
Exactly.
That's kind of the central question.
Right.
And every theology wrestles with that question. So with her kind of pairing those things together, it makes me see prosperity gospel as a legitimate voice in the conversation. Now, whether or not I agree with it, but she kind of reframes it, because if it's just an economic theory, I'm like, I don't buy that.
Right.
But when she says it's about theodicy, I have to pay attention.
Yeah, and I think that's because liberals ask that question more often, right? So the progressive folks are like, why do bad things happen to good people? And then they come up with some answer that usually is a critique of the traditional theological framework. And so the fact that she goes into the language of theodicy helps you see that we could have ended up here when we asked that first question.
Mm-hmm.
The answer could have been, oh, well, we're just not faithful enough. You know, and that could have been the answer.
And there's biblical basis for that answer.
Right. It also shows that even though we don't understand these in the terms of, like, when we think liberal and conservative in American life, we think of politically. But there's also like a big L liberalism, which is a theological or philosophical terminology, which means departing from the mainline tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And prosperity gospel is actually a form of liberalism because it's a departure from the main tradition. It's a theodicy question, right? It's an answer to the theodicy question, that in the same way that other answers to the theodicy question critique the framework, so does prosperity. Because almost nobody in Christian history had ever thought that way about the Bible or about the gospel until it came. That's a new gospel. It's a new theology as in the way that it's operating. It may be a new take on an old way of thinking, but it's a critique of the tradition. It's a new gospel.
So I understand that prosperity gospel has now permeated, you know, the globe. But is this an originally American idea?
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, prosperity gospel is a uniquely American concept that is pioneered. My understanding in reading her book about this, so I'm using Kate as sort of the foundation and the authority, is that it was born out of the word faith movement, which is this sort of predominantly out of the Pentecostal tradition that believes that if you speak it and you speak it with faith, that it will happen. A word spoken in faith will happen. And they tie that to biblical passages where people did that and something did happen. Miraculous things occurred related to somebody speaking in faith. And that began to evolve and got a lot of what I would consider to be American capitalist theological – I mean, capitalism is a theology too, not just an economic theory. So American capitalism roped into it, and it became what we now know as the prosperity gospel. But all the televangelists in the 80s and the 70s that folks got soured on religion on were influenced by that word faith movement and began to unfold the prosperity gospel. I mean, you don't get on TV and say, if you send me this money and you're going to get healed, that's prosperity gospel. So it's been going on for a long time now, but it's deeply rooted in the American way of thinking about it. I like to joke, actually, just to that point, I'm glad you brought this up, because I think there are only two gospels that are unique to America. One is the social gospel and one is the prosperity gospel. And I think those are a good juxtaposition to look through the way in which faith interacts with American politics to see how people land. from a religious perspective, they're almost always either landing from a prosperity gospel perspective or from a social gospel perspective.
That's true. Interesting. I hadn't thought about it that way.
Yeah.
So, you know, we talked a little bit about Kate, who she is. We talked a little bit about her Mennonite background and then moving into her studies, which are prosperity gospel, kind of what is prosperity gospel, you know, and you know, she talks about how she has grown to kind of adopt some of these principles in her own life, like truly believing that faith will make a way.
Yeah.
But then all of a sudden she gets to a place where life intervenes and she says, I don't believe that anymore.
Right. Yeah, there's that turn on page, I guess, what is 10, 14? Yeah. I mean, when she gets the diagnosis, she just says, I believe that God would make a way, which is how she describes the prosperity gospel. And then
right.
she says, I don't believe that anymore. And it all circles around getting the news of the cancer diagnosis.
Yeah.
And what that – how that basically shatters her theology in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
I mean, that to me is such an important moment in the preface. I feel like we need to spend some time there because I feel like that's a common experience, thinking in terms of daily practice for a lot of our people and how do people wrestle with theological concepts and spirituality and does God exist or not and how is God involved in my life? It oftentimes those major points, if you were to draw a map, in fact, actually once I was asked by in a spiritual formation thing to map my spirituality over my life,
right.
starting when I was born. So you write a map and you just like do high points and low points and where was God in the high points and low points and where does that map on your life history?
Mm-hmm.
And what you kind of discover is that a lot of the low points and high points of both your spiritual life apply right to the high points and low points of your regular life.
Exactly.
And so it's usually something that happens to you that's outside of your control that you didn't think was going to happen or some hopes and dreams that you had that got squashed or something like that that causes you to reframe your theological framework that you were handed or that you inherited from your family. And I think those moments are those are such powerful, profound moments in our lives that we turn back to and remember and carry with us as we go forward because they are both deeply painful.
Mm-hmm.
But also revelatory and eye-opening and transformative because I don't think we're ever the same after we go through those experiences. Our beliefs change. Our theology is shaped by those experiences. And then we go on and we are different people in relationship to them.
Yeah. And I think, too, a lot of times fear is overlaid with all of this stuff. Like when we're thinking about the spiritual map and how it coincides with the life map and how the life event kind of is a lightning bolt moment that strikes through both lines and changes the person forever. Most of us are raised within a home environment that has its own norms, right? And those norms can train us to be a certain kind of people or to believe a certain kind of thing about the way the world works or a certain kind of thing about the way that God is in relationship with us. And the reality is, none of our lives play out in the same way that our parents' lives played out.
Right.
Or that our guardians, you know, whoever raises us, like we have different lives, we have different experiences, and culture moves forward.
Right.
And so we have to reckon with things that our parents wrestled with in a different way. So I'm thinking, like, for me personally, you know, I was raised in the Southern Baptist tradition, which meant a certain thing for women.
Mm.
And, you know, my parents pushed that a little bit, but not in the same ways that I pushed that. And so my whole theology was constructed around a sociology about what a woman is and what does that mean to be embodied in a woman's body and how does that play out in terms of vocation and relationships and intellect and power. And so when those – like I learned something intellectually and it changed everything, like at just the right moment in my personal life where I'm like figuring out who I am, et cetera. And I feel like for some of us it's illness, like in Kate's example, but for some of us it's just – it's a relationship or it's a life event or it's an academic learning that challenges an entire framework, you know, within which your identity has been formed.
Yep.
So it's like deeply spiritual, but it's also super scary.
Yeah.
Because the whole world as you knew it is a lie.
Right. That's right.
So how do you move into that?
Right. And I think some people are much more open to the possibility that what they had been handed was a lie and others resist that much harder because they're worried about the framework of their life eroding around them if they realize it, if they accept that, if they agree with what she says, if everything doesn't happen for a reason, then what?
Yeah, then everything's chaos. And
then everything's chaos, and is there even really a God? And I thought, you know, everything was predestined. Yeah. It was all going to work out, you know.
It's so funny to me that, like, Christians really expect God to be orderly, when at the very beginning, like, the first sentence of the Bible describes God hovering over chaos.
Right.
So,
right.
Like, if we know one thing about God, we know that God hovers over chaos.
Oh, yeah. And I always go back to, because, and that's tied to the Genesis narrative, is that Job moment, right, where God is like, I love, like, these big monsters I created. And Job's like, what the heck are you talking about, dude? I'm over here suffering. Yeah. And God's like, did you see that whale I created? I love that whale. It's amazing. Can you create a whale? No, I created one. Job's like, what kind of answer is that? You know, it's like, that's chaos. God's like created this thing, and he likes watching things just live and be filled with life and sometimes bump up into each other and eat each other and stuff. Like, that's part of life.
That's part of God.
Death and – I mean, cancer, right? Yeah. Like, cancer is also part of life. It is a mutation of cells that happens to bodies.
Right.
It happens to dog bodies. It happens to human bodies.
It sounds like some of those beasts that God created in the life of Job, just in, you know, the 21st century.
Yeah.
But I was also thinking that, like, as you're talking, you know, when we experience these moments, it seems like our understanding of the future really impacts how we navigate through them. Like, Kate's life moment is a cancer diagnosis that interrupts and puts a definitive end on everything that she'd been working towards. Mm. And so it's not just a reframe about what does my future look like. It's a what if my future doesn't exist.
Right. If there is no future, what does it mean to say that God will make a way?
Yeah.
That's why she says, like, I don't believe that. Sometimes there is no way and it's just life.
That's right.
And that's a huge pill to swallow, that forces her to, like, wrestle with theological convictions throughout this book in ways that are really vulnerable and also so true, so honest, and it's what we all deal with, you know? And I was thinking about it in terms of how death, as you've pointed out, cancer, death, how they cause actually evil too, how they cause theological questioning. So some people have even said, anthropologists say that the only reason that there is such a thing as religion is because human beings die. Mm-hmm. And they had to make sense of what does it mean that somebody dies. And so they created religion out of that. I don't necessarily buy that totally, but I think that that's an interesting idea. You know, death is a problem for all religious traditions, mm-hmm. that they have to figure out what to say about it.
Yeah.
You know, evil is a problem for all religious traditions. They have to figure out what to say about it, just like prosperity gospel is built there. And so wrestling with death and evil, wrestling with the death of those we love, wrestling with our own mortality, wrestling with the way that evil creates more death in the world than we would have otherwise, those are deep philosophical and theological and religious problems that theologies and that start with our individual experience.
Yeah. When I think to add to that list, it would also kind of address her questions with, like, God, are you here? And what does the suffering mean? I think we have to add suffering and solitude.
Yes.
As, you know, as part of the human condition that makes us consider, you know, is there something more?
Right.
You know, what is the suffering for? Like, some would say it's for, you know, the development of spiritual character. You know?
Right.
But
That's
some
right.
would say it's pointless.
Right. Right. Some say there's some kind of redemptive suffering or there's redemption in suffering or that comes out of suffering. Lots of different ways theologians try to make sense of it. And then others are like, no, it's just meaningless.
Yeah.
Suffering is just suffering. It's part of life.
Yeah.
It's just it's there.
Yeah. And then that question of, and then where is God?
Right.
You know, which is related to, am I alone in this? But, like, I'm thinking about a liberation theology, which would have God intervening as liberator from suffering.
Right.
You know, so, but when the suffering endures, where is God?
The interesting thing about that is, and this obviously goes into work that we're going to be doing as a church, is that all of those things that we mentioned have to do with the body.
That's exactly right.
Our bodies suffer, right? And our minds are part of our body. So even if our minds are suffering, even if we're emotionally suffering, our emotions are part of our mind, which is part of our bodies. So our bodies are suffering, right? I mean, death is about the death of a body, you know, the loss of a body, the absence of a body in our lives. It's all of it's tied back to the body, which causes theological issues for us because we have these frail things that we have to deal with.
Exactly. And I feel like Kate's book is so good at helping us bridge that connection. You know, we're just starting this fall the series on Awakening the Body, which explores the connection between our spirituality and our bodies, and tries to help us understand what does it mean to be spiritual beings who are embodied just by nature of being who we are. And I think sometimes that question feels like utterly theoretical. Mm-hmm. And even in trying to communicate what is the series about, people want to know, like, you know, you say the title, you kind of explain it, they glaze over, and then you're like, you know, you ask the question, has your body ever impeded your practice of faith? Mm. And they're like, oh, hold on a minute. You know, have you ever had that diagnosis? Have you been in this room or received this call? And, you know, later on in the book, she goes into some other experiences with body failures that I think might be a little bit, they're even broader because they're more widely experienced than death at this point.
Absolutely.
And so I love the way that she just says, you know, my body experienced cancer. And immediately I ask, God, are you here?
Mm.
And, you know, I think about how many of us do that without naming it. And so the point of the series is to help us name it, because walking around disembodied souls is not helpful.
Right.
And so to try to help us move back together so that we can give theological credibility to those body moments, you know. Mm-hmm. You fall down, scrape your knee, you're five, it hurts. God,
right.
Where are you? You know? You're 25, your whole world, you know, maybe you're a 25-year-old gay person coming out of the closet for the first time. Your family abandons you and tells you you're going to hell every time you see them. God, where are you?
Yeah. I mean, I think the body seems to be a problem for Christian theology. It's like a problem that needs an answer, and all the answers tend to make things worse, it seems, over the course of history. And I think the thing that I learned about this and that I'm still wrestling with, and it's, I think it's so liberating, but it's also really scary. So it's exhilarating, but also terrifying. And that is that every time the theological tradition has been shaken up throughout Christian history, it has almost always been because they tried to deal with the body presented itself in a different way. Human bodies presented themselves as a problem, and theology had to try to shift around it. And I think what we learn about that is that theologies like to be neat and tidy and systematic.
Yes.
And bodies are incredibly messy and very hard to contain.
Yep.
They make messes. They don't work all the time. They don't look exactly right. They're not perfectly symmetrical and beautiful all the time. They're big. They're small. They're bony. They're weird. They're just bodies. They're messy, but also beautiful creations of God. And so that's what theology ought to look like if it's embodied. Embodied theology has to be messy, but we want the neat and tidy theology that gives us lots of answers that are really – that never change and that's always clean, right?
Yeah.
And where there's no ambiguity and we don't really have to ask questions and there's certainty about what's coming next and this means this and Christ died, therefore Christ is resurrected automatically. You know, it's like all this systematic, clean stuff. And actually, life is messy. Creation is messy. God is messy. Bodies are messy. Why are we trying to make it neat, right?
Yeah. Well, and I think that might go back all the way to our primal instinct that makes us desire to be part of an in-group, right? Like, our bodies are the one thing that we cannot escape. I'm in this body. I have orange hair and crooked knees everywhere I show up. It just is who I am. And so, you know, I'm going to work my way in to try to figure out how I can make this body fit in with some kind of group norm that's pre-established.
Mm-hmm.
So, what you know, a lot of times it looks like traditional masculinity and femininity.
Yep.
And anything outside of those norms is terrifying because you've got to create your own in-group somewhere.
Right.
And nobody else is willing to even admit that they don't belong in that traditionally defined group.
Normative forms of sexuality.
That's right.
Yeah, identity, look, dress. I mean, this is why subcultures are often created by creating their own form of dress and appearance. And this is why people pierce their bodies and get tattoos and – I mean, we're dealing with something deeply human here. Subcultures, things we do to our bodies, ways to – because our bodies are our identity.
Yeah.
We cannot be ourselves without our bodies. And so we try to figure out who we are through our bodies.
Right. And I also – they are our primary identity, but they're also our primary interpretive lens. Like if you think about seeing the world through a pair of glasses, nobody has a zero prescription on.
Right.
Because our brains, you know, just the very ways that we remember events or that we experience events, they're all tied to past experiences or ways that we've been socialized or information that we have taken on in our brains. And, you know, there's a move, and I've promised Ben that I wouldn't get too far into this, but there's like a move in modern neuroscience that talks about how brain injuries help us challenge this idea that we might be able to that our bodies don't impact who we are.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Like
yeah.
If you injure a certain part of your brain, your emotions change.
Right.
And just the connectivity is always, always there. So to pretend like we can engage in a theological conversation that is disembodied is not true.
And yet we do it all the time. And so like to go back into – if we're going to go to the depth, going into some of the background philosophically and theologically that you and I have talked about before this, like how did we get to a place where we think that we can – have a relationship with God without a body? How do we think that? Why do we think that? Or why do we think you can worship God without a body? You can't.
Yeah.
You can't do anything without – you can't practice your faith without a body. You can't worship God without a body. You can't pray without a body.
Well, and so I – like we have to – this is kind of like our point that we want to – or one of the points that we want to talk about this year. And it's so ironic because like the opposite of being embodied as a human is being dead. And yet,
that's
like
right.
We all
want
to argue that we can live our lives disembodied.
That's right.
Which
that's
you know, right. When our bodies don't work, we're dead, folks.
We are dead.
Like it's
yeah.
It's true, but yeah. So how do we get here? You know,
I think part of it. I mean, we can go through all the names and the philosophies and all that stuff, but to me, it's what you'll always find is we created some kind of either dualism or compartmentalization of the human person, and we said a human person is made up of this, this, and this: body, mind, soul. They're made up of these. And then we focus on one, and we focus on one to the detriment of another. And we forget that there is they're all integrated, and you can't really distinguish them from one another. And there are a lot of these distinctions and compartmentalizations that we make are arbitrary and not real. And this is why we debate about the word spirit or soul. Which one is it? Is it spirit? Is it soul? We don't know. We don't know. Because we're guessing, you know. Are our emotions part of our body? Yeah, they come out of our brain. Is our brain part of our body? Yeah, it's tissue.
Yeah.
You know, it's a tissue. It's in there. You can't – like you don't have a brain out here. If you take a brain out and put it on a table, it's not working.
That's
you know?
Right.
So it needs a body to live within. And even if you could get it to work over on a table like that evil villain in the Ninja Turtles, the brain or whatever, Krag I think his name was. Anyway, that's not a real human being. Right?
Right.
It's something other than a human being.
Right.
So there have been these moves within both theology and then both philosophy and then theology kind of following these philosophical moves that have divided body from soul or body from spirit or emotion from reason. That's another one
that gets done
all the time, right?
Yep.
These kind of bifurcations that happen, and they're all really arbitrary. The human person is really a whole. Breaking it down in those categories helpful for a short period of time, but you have to remember that the human person is a whole.
Yeah, and I also want to just add that over the development of these kind of theories, the characters who end up having a prominent voice over the course of history are often men who really wrestle with sexuality and sexual temptation in ways that they interpret breaking social cultural norms. So like Augustine,
yeah,
right, classic. And out of this kind of struggling that people have over the course of history with their own temptations or with like, what does sexuality look like if it's not a polygamous marriage with one male and lots of females for the production of lots of children, which
yes.
Obviously that's not where we are today, but
yeah.
Yet, but we still hold on to some pieces of that kernel and we try to apply it in our modern context. But what that does is it reinforces a narrative that's really not it's not a deep narrative. It's a narrative that's built out of fear around what happens to the human body when, you know, when we're willing to really go there with sexuality, when we're willing to go there and let bodies be unleashed a little bit and inspired or inspirited a little bit without predetermining what's okay and what's not okay for those bodies to do or imposing something from, you know, 300 about what those bodies
right.
are supposed to do.
And when you think the body is a problem, then everything in your faith becomes about sublimating desire, right, and shutting down desire. And even Augustine, right, is about rightly ordered desire, but a lot of it is about just cutting it off completely
yeah.
as if we can somehow stop the human person from being a person that is fearful, or we can stop the human person from having sexual appetite, or we can stop the human person from wanting to eat.
Right.
You know, we can talk about what they eat and who they have sex with, but you can't, cutting off,
to cut it off
their desire is almost an attack on creation itself.
Yes.
Right? It's like, what are you saying about the body God created? You're saying that somehow it's a problem. God created a problem. It's in the same way, this is how bodies that are black bodies or brown bodies that suddenly appear to the Western colonial body become a problem. And they see these bodies for the first time when they're colonizing native lands, and they suddenly don't know what to do with it because they've never had it. And so they somehow think the only thing that they can do with it is sublimate it, you know, and oppress it. And the same thing happens when a new sexuality comes into place, that it's driven by a bodily desire and Western church doesn't know what to do with it, or a gender identity issue comes and the Western church doesn't know what to do with a gender identity, or just women in general. The Western church has not known what to do with women, right, in relationship to that. So it's always this body is problem or body is dangerous. Body leads towards hell if we allow it to express its desire or fulfill its desire. And so we want to cut off desires and put lots of blocks and legalistic rules around desire to try to make sure we keep the body from becoming a problem that leads us to hell.
That's like the
danger.
Well, and also because this book is largely centered around medical problems with bodies, it's coming up into my mind about the AIDS crisis, right? So an illness comes into our realm of understanding. We scapegoat a group of people who have embraced the body in a different way than Christians have historically. And so we scapegoat them and disregard the fact that heterosexual people all over the world can contract AIDS. And,
right.
you know, and we blame an illness on sinfulness.
That's biblical. I mean, that's what Jesus is dealing with in the New Testament, right? It's like clean and unclean, you know, lepers and sick people on the side of the road that nobody will touch, and the guy with his withered hand. And this is Jesus dealing with the illness and shame and honor, illness as sin culture in the New Testament first century, and he's trying to overcome that. And that's the – Jesus is saying, actually, no, that's not – bodily deformity doesn't mean sinfulness, doesn't mean hereditary original sin or hereditary sin from the father, you know, that the next generation is fulfilling. It's actually just – a part of the world, a created finitude. And so I'm going to deal with these people. I'm going to touch them. I'm going to love them. I'm going to care for them. And so Jesus shows us this deep love for all bodies throughout the New Testament that is really shocking to the powers in the religious establishment of the day.
Yeah. And the movement of those bodies with interacting with Jesus is really important to me. Like Jesus, those are the bodies that society has pushed aside in the same ways that we as a society have pushed aside black and brown bodies or immigrant bodies or sick bodies or you know, differently abled bodies. We've pushed them out. And yet Jesus says, no, centralize and magnify those bodies.
Right.
And I think about our theologies and what we do with kind of shushing or blaming on sinfulness as a way of marginalizing those bodies instead of centralizing them and really wrestling with the question itself as a theological question.
Yeah, and I think the theological wrestling match then is the problem with all those stories is not just – we don't read them on the surface level as Jesus-affirming bodies. We read them as miracles and miraculous healings, and so we find ourselves falling into prosperity gospel.
That's
to
right.
come back to Kate's book, right? So it's like – we see those stories of Jesus and everyone ends with somebody getting healed and walking away. And we think, okay, that's what our theology should be about. If you pray, somebody's going to get healed. And so we should just pray harder, pray harder, pray harder. And maybe that means like if Kate's right or if she's dealing with a theological concept, well, I wonder what she would say to the if God doesn't always make a way, then what do those stories actually mean? What is Jesus actually doing? Are they really about the healing or are they about something else?
Yeah. Okay, I want to just jump to a different place real quick.
Good.
Moving along through her book, I'm in chapter one, I'm looking at page four, and it just occurred to me that when Kate receives her call, when she receives the call from the doctor's office that says, like, hey, you know, something's not right, you got to come in, her sentence says, I'm at the office pacing at my treadmill desk and flipping through my latest research when my phone rings.
Mm.
And all of that is so embodied. It didn't occur to me the first time, but like she's a body that's bought into this myth of like essential productivity so much that she's on a treadmill desk.
While she's working.
Yeah. And I mean, I believe in a treadmill desk and I want one desperately, but I've never before been convicted by that want that like a body can't take care of itself and from a wellness perspective without, you know, because that requires ceasing productivity.
Yeah.
And then it all of a sudden she receives this call. It reminds me of a line from one of Barbara Brown Taylor's books where she says, if you do not take your Sabbath, your body will impose it upon you.
Mm.
You know, so if you don't rest, you're going to get sick. Basically.
That is a great quote.
But anyway, so just like this, you know, circling back to the book, moving from the preface into chapter one, which is all about her receiving the call, the diagnosis.
Yes.
And, you know, just the fact that it happens while she's engaging in the work of the body in so many levels, and then her body says no.
And I think that's one of the important ways that deals with our contemporary discussions around health is that we think that if we just keep our eat right and exercise right, nothing will ever happen to our body. That's one myth.
That
and the other one is that everything bad that happens to our body is a result of something bad we did. So we think, oh, yeah. They got lung cancer? They must have been a smoker.
Yeah.
Or they got prostate cancer? Or what'd they get again? Oh, well, that they should have ate more strawberries, right? It's like, no. I mean, this is that – it's like that cause and effect thing. Instead of just living with the ambiguity, right, and living into the fact that we have these finite bodies and stuff just happens sometimes. It doesn't matter what age we are. It's also this example like wellness is not an age question.
That's right.
Wellness is a very different kind of conversation. It has nothing to do with age.
Yeah. That's exactly right. So, yeah, so she's in this moment. She has this diagnosis. And then, kind of fast forwarding. Mm. I want to fast forward to the end of the chapter,
yeah,
basically, because she spends the time kind of remembering her life, lamenting where she is in her life when she receives this diagnosis, kind of thinking about her child, her husband, what are they going to do without her? And she extroverts, basically, this chapter. And then she gets to the end, and she's like, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. I just don't know what to do. And her friend says in a quiet voice, die. And, you know, and then Kate kind of – go ahead.
Yeah, she almost says it like, was it sarcastic? Was it a question or a fact? But she said it, and it's like, oh, that's something to do?
Yeah.
And is that the only thing? It's she says that like she connects that at the end of a whole section about impossible thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
That the only thing that she can do is the work of dying. And
yeah.
that's how she leaves us with this chapter. Also with her friend knowing to burn the dress, right?
Oh my gosh, yes, exactly. but yeah, I mean, and it makes me wonder what Enneagram type Kate is.
Mm.
Like how do you – what is death? Is it a surrender of control?
Mm.
Is it accepting failure? Is it recognizing human finitude?
Is it limitation?
Is it limitation? You know, what is it?
Or the end, no future?
Yeah.
For her, it sounds like she's painting it, and I don't even know how aware of her language she is on this because it's so beautifully written, but she says, it's no way. God will make a way. So for me, it feels like she's saying, there is no future. And no future with my husband, no future with my son, no future body for me, no love, no future. You know, it's really interesting. She's really bracketing that sort of like pie in the sky, heaven, I can't wait to go be with God stuff. You know, it's like, nope, this means no future with my husband and my kid. God's not making a way for me there. And so that's what death means, just no way forward.
No way. That's so interesting. And I haven't finished the book yet, so I'm not sure how this evolves for her. So I'll be reading this with you. You know, but when I think about this and when I'm interpreting her words here, it's like it's a rejection. Like it is impossible. Like I cannot do that.
Mm.
And I wonder if that's submission or refusal or like denial. Like is she saying, I can't die. Death has to happen to me. Or is she saying, like, I'm not going there?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, what makes it impossible?
Could be both. I mean, the impossible thoughts is just such an awesome term because we have those all the time. They're like, I will not think about this thing that's happening to me. I reject that I'm going through it. That's denial.
That is.
That's the first stage of grief, right,
yeah.
And loss. So she's basically showing us what denial feels like. It's like, no, I'm not going to think about that. That's not going to happen. I'm not going to die.
Yeah.
That's a lie, you know, or this bad thing's not going to happen to me. You know, my spouse is never going to leave me. I mean, these impossible thoughts that we have that we just don't want to admit what's going on in the world that we're living in.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, reaching the end of the chapter, I know there's a lot more to talk about, but I kind of want to bracket us and leave some questions out there for people to kind of think about. So what I would hope for us to think about after reading the preface in chapter one would be, you know, what have been those moments of intervention in your life or experience or arrest or whatever where life has caused you to ask the question, where are you, God?
Yeah.
You know, or why this suffering? or something like that. Just those big questions that just change everything and make all the future look like chaos.
Yeah, and if you know what those are, then maybe ask yourself the question of the title, which is like, what are the lies that you loved and do you believe them anymore? What are the things you don't believe anymore that you did believe before?
Yeah. Oh, that's so good. I'm ready to think.
All righty.
All right, see you next time.
We'll talk to you next time.